and carrying amounts of the existing cash-generating units of the acquirer. We refer to this buffer as a pre-acquisition headroom. Now, in the paper, we've developed the approach further to show how we think it could be applied to if there's more than one acquisition or disposals or reorganizations of operations. We've also listed what we think are the main strengths and weaknesses of our approach in paragraph 34 to assist our discussion today. We acknowledge having a frozen headroom is not as effective as updating the headroom for each impairment test, but we think our approach responds to concerns impairments are being recognised too late while also striking a necessary cost-benefit balance. Do board members have any comments or suggestions on the approach or suggestions for how to proceed?
I like the idea. I think it's practical. I think there's also more than anecdotal evidence that currently repairers are looking for cash-generating units which have a lot of headroom so that they won't touch an impairment very quickly. I think the method that you propose shouldn't be overly costly. By the way, we still have to look at other measures to make the impairment perhaps less costly, which could compensate for this. It's definitely wrong in impairments to consider the headroom. So I like the idea. Daryl.
I probably in the same place as Hans to an extent. I think we should be very clear that there are limitations here. So we know what the limitations are. We're solving one of the issues that's been raised with us, which is the fact that headroom otherwise creates this buffer effect, and the buffer means that there is a delay. And you don't really know you've got a problem until you've eaten through something, you've eaten quite considerably through something. I think the other point to emphasize, and I think it comes in some of the earlier paragraphs where you're very clear that firstly, from a process perspective, the process you're talking about you have to have developed in any case. Because the process of evaluating the goodwill for the CGU is one that you have to do on a regular basis in any case, and you're simply having to perform that process one more time. And then you're having to hold the balance to. So I think it has got advantages, but I think whatever we do, we need to be very clear that we understand and accept the limitations that are there.
Yeah.
And that we are only solving one specific issue, and then ask about that additional process that we've added. The additional running of the process, not the additional process, in the context of weighing up the benefits and costs of it.
Stephen.
So I also like the approach. I think we shouldn't get too hung up on it being imperfect, because I think it's less imperfect than the existing approach. I've just got one question, and that's on paragraph 22. Which is the situation where a second acquisition takes place. And I think you need to think about this carefully, because the proposal that you've got, to my mind, opens up the door to some manipulation and gaming. Because if I have a situation where I've done one acquisition, things are not looking good, value's declining, in order to avoid an impairment, I could do a second acquisition, small transaction, restate the pre-acquisition headroom, and then avoid such a big impairment. So I think we need to think about different scenarios there and what the implications would be. I'm not sure that is the right answer.
Gary?
Thank you. I have somewhat tepid support for the thing. I think it's got its merits, and as Daryl had said, it's got its limitations, but I think it's got, as proposed here, some significant limitations. Because what will happen, you have a good acquisition, but if the pre-acquisition headroom drops, you've got an impairment. Mm-hmm. So I think that's not going to go over well if we actually formally propose this approach in due course, which would say, I think we've got to open it up that you have either the obligation or the option to reevaluate or reassess pre-acquisition headroom down the line. it, I think that's inevitable.
Sorry, Gary, for interrupting, but you said when the pre-acquisition headroom drops, then you're in trouble, but it isn't, because it isn't remeasured.
No, but you might have, I think it has to get remeasured, I believe. Yet if you think you've got an impairment, is when you reassess the impairment tests and you say, gee, I got an impairment. But what if but you're doing a larger cash generating unit, and the business unit you bought that's got the goodwill might be fine. It's the rest of the stuff that deteriorated. So I think you have to have the option, either requirement or the option, to remeasure the pre-acquisition headroom down the line. I think, Michelle, I think we agree that that's one of the limiting consequences of the model.
Gary, wouldn't you? That mean you were then monitoring goodwill at a lower level, and R36 requires you then to do the measurement of impairment at that level.
But remember, what are we trying to do? This is my last comment, but I'll make it now. Is when you go to the PIRs, what problem are we trying to solve? The complexity of the impairment testing, which I think this probably makes it more complex if you have to either reassess pre-acquisition headroom, or you make it more likely you're going to have an impairment, and you've still got all the limitations in the current impairment testing model, which for the most part we haven't discussed yet. Mm-hmm. Is the concern just impairments aren't being recognized, as soon as they should be, or is our concern we just want to find a vehicle to get goodwill off the books because nothing lasts forever, which would argue for more of an amortization type approach. So I think the PIR's problem statement was the impairment test is very difficult and awkward to do. I think this actually, since this puts more goodwill into impairment because you remove a buffer, I don't think it does anything to simplify the test.
Gary, what it does do, and I thought that the only thing this was doing was making sure that as soon as there was a negative action or a fall in the amount of absolute goodwill, you recognize it immediately instead of under the predecessor one. You would only recognize it once you had used up all the pre-acquisition goodwill. And so I think the only thing this is trying to do, if I understand it correctly, is bring that recognition process earlier.
Right.
The idea of remeasuring pre-acq goodwill actually defeats that.
Gary's saying it's not fair in the sense if you know that definitely knew that it related to the pre-acquisition goodwill. That's your.
If you can demonstrate the buying entity or the pre-existing entity is what declined,
absolutely,
and the acquisition is proceeding, I think this model will.
Absolutely. I'd always thought that the objective of determining the CGU was to say essentially from that point going forward, you were looking at that entire, the assets and liabilities, as a single pot.
Yeah.
So from the instant that you've created the CGU, there is no such thing anymore as the predecessor and the
purchase. I understand
the
that, but
it's now one single pot.
It's one single pot, but the goodwill only came from one part of that pot. And that's the problem.
Yeah.
And now sometimes you buy that, there's acquisitions that are sort of left intact and you drop them into a CGU. Then there's other ones. They're the last piece of the puzzle and that makes the entire unitary group work better. Therefore, maybe the pre-acquisition headroom should be a factor.
I may be then thinking differently about how you would determine the CGU, but it seems to me like you are actually determining the CGU in that circumstance at too high a level.
Units,
in fact, the old one and the new one.
And maybe you are, and again, maybe the answer is, but again, the problem is companies as you buy, as we all know, sometimes acquisitions stay at a low level and are left semi-independent, and other times you're inserted at a higher level and fully matriculated, and absorbed in it. So I think, like I said, my support was tepid, but I think the limitations in this thing are pretty big. And back to the original PIR statement, simplify the impairment testing. This removes something that makes impairment opportunities, if you will, earlier, but it still hasn't addressed how you actually, the PIR concerns.
This is more addressing the too little too late problem.
It is, but again, that's going back to what are we trying to solve, a way to get goodwill efficiently off the books or to recognize an acquisition that's coming up way short of its intent. We haven't really discussed that.
And Gary, we will be bringing to you ideas about how to improve the impairment test in future board meetings. Mm-hmm. So this is really just looking at this one particular point about the sort of too little, too late problem. But we will come back with more proposals.
Like I say, it solves some of the issue. I'm not trying to argue any of that, but I think you'd have to really deal with, is there a feasible remeasure pre-acquisition headroom?
Martin is now giving his less than tepid support.
Less than tepid.
I really don't like this. As I have said already in the last meeting, it was not really difficult because I said it already last time. But I really think maybe it will resolve this too little too late, but it will, I think, it is conceptually flawed and will maybe lead into too much too early. And the reason is because, okay, we don't really updating this buffer. And a simple example, if you have this buffer and date of acquisition, and then you remeasure maybe 1 year later the combined cash generating unit, which includes the buffer and includes really then the new goodwill or the new acquisition, and the discount rate changes. And the discount rate changes, let's assume, is increasing. So the total value goes down, but you don't updating the buffer, it can immediately throw into an impairment, but maybe half of that is relating to the pre-acquisition goodwill. And therefore, I think it is conceptually flawed. And maybe we will solve this problem too little too late, but we get other problems. And as Gary said, it is not addressing all this simplification. It adds more cost and adds to, or will bring another conceptual problem. So from too little too late, too much too early. And the problem is really, this model can only work if you really could update the buffer. But this is not possible. That is really the problem. And therefore, I think this method is conceptually flawed.
Thank you. I think this approach is good, and we should develop more. The good point of this approach is we have crystallized the fundamental flaw of the impairment-only approach. And the impairment-only approach has a fundamental flaw, I think, is because we have different measurement basis in a single unit of account. We commingle the acquired goodwill and the pre-existing goodwill and pre-existing asset and acquired asset. It's all commingled in the one cash generating unit. So therefore, if you try to identify what is the value of the goodwill, then only we can do is to put it as a residual. So then we cannot single out goodwill, and we cannot measure it directly. So we have to calculate it based on the residual. However, we have a commingled assets. So that is the fundamental flaw of the current impairment test. And you singled out there is a headroom. So that is a very good point. However, I have a little bit of sympathy to what the Martin said. And the difficulty of measuring headroom is also exists. So therefore, headroom itself would be calculated something like residual. So therefore, it is quite difficult when it comes to the second acquisition or third acquisition. And actually, headroom exists in other assets as well. So like you pointed out, if you have a land, and land has significant unrecognized gain, then that would be included in the headroom. So my question is, what if the company acquiring company sold the land which had a huge unrecognized gain and then realized the gain? What will happen? So are we going to remeasure headroom?
Is that the issue I addressed in the paper, where talking about the relative basis, unless the company thinks another basis for allocating the pre-acquisition headroom on disposal is appropriate?
Right. So then on the second acquisition, so you are going to, in a sense, include those selling activity? If the company sold the land with the huge unrealized gain.
Mm-hmm. Then there may be a more appropriate basis of taking out more of the pre-acquisition headroom. I think I addressed this in paragraph 25 to 28.
sale.
An example with the land, but I did an example with the land giving rise to most of the pre-acquisition headroom, being retained in the unit rather than disposed.
So the point I wanted to address here is the pre-acquisition headroom exists in every case, in every kind of asset. Say, for example, if you have inventory, so there are a variety of methods to measure the inventory value. So actually, this is something like a FIFO approach. So if you have a moving average method, then it contains headroom, because you will calculate moving average, including the headroom of pre-acquired inventory. So then, moving average method is something like containing headroom. So that we allow it in the inventory area. And what we are doing is to do the FIFO approach for the goodwill which you acquired. You do not count on the headroom. So then, in a sense, what the margin said makes sense, because you have to recognize impairment to single out the acquired goodwill only, without averaging the inventory you have. So in a sense, we could say it could be too much too early. However, the good point of this method is we identify the fundamental flow of impairment only. And as you explained in your paper, goodwill is very special. It's different from other assets. We cannot identify what the goodwill is all about. Therefore, we need to introduce a little bit stronger rigor than other assets. So that's that point I can support.
Philippe? Yes, I think the idea is interesting and is worth pursuing and exposing maybe, but I think we have to recognize it will be effective only if the acquisition is allocated to an existing CGU.
What?
Only if the acquisition, acquired entity, is allocated to an existing CGU, and if that existing CGU is big enough in comparison to the acquisition. Because if you have a small CGU acquiring a large entity, then what you will use as an offset against the purchase price is the headroom in that small CGU, which may be very little in comparison to the acquisition. And the effectiveness of that approach would be very limited in that case.
But in that case, the whole problem is also very small to begin with. Mm.
Well, you may have a large goodwill in the acquisition, and what you will offset as headroom is very small.
Yes, so but you don't have a big buffer to begin with.
Well, yeah, maybe, but it doesn't address the overpayment and the possibility of having overpaid the acquisition. Hence, we have to continue in parallel to that to work on the other situations where you may have indications of overpayment. And we probably need to address this question of what is it that prevents an entity to recognize the overpayment at the time of the acquisition or very soon after, and to write it off without waiting for some more evidence. So, now, I have another question. Is there a risk that preparers who will not like it, probably as Gary said, and Martin, they will not be very enthusiastic about the extra cost and complexity that is imposed by this proposal? What is the risk that they will maybe no longer allocate acquisitions to existing CGUs and will pretend that this is a new CGU?
I was going to make
pressure on the allocation.
Is that a bad thing? Hmm? Would that be a bad thing?
I don't know. I think we have to consider the risk of bias in behaviors that would be introduced by this.
I wonder whether that would move us closer to a situation where they're monitoring goodwill based on just a separate acquisition basis rather than bundling it with existing goodwill, which is what the standard currently permits.
Yeah, just to avoid the cost and complexity of doing that, they may just change their behaviors. So is that a good thing? I don't know. I think it's not discussed here. We have to consider it in a later phase, the behavioral impact of this requirement.
So
I was going to raise exactly that point, but not necessarily as a concern, just as an observation, because it seemed to me that if you had a situation like Gary suggested, where you felt that you may have a possibility or likelihood that the sort of original part of the business might behave differently to the acquisition part of the business, you might be more inclined to not bundle them together because of this proposal. But if they were going to behave so differently anyway, would we want them to put them together in the first place? So I think it's good. I don't think it's going to solve all of the problems, but I think this sort of buffer problem, it should be helpful to address, and it may partly address it indirectly by changing the way people think about CGUs. But if we were to put it out for comment, I think one of the things we should be sort of cognizant of and sort of upfront about on the basis would be the potential for this sort of behaviour, and is that a good or a bad thing? And that would be something I'd want to draw out from it. But I think it doesn't sound terribly onerous to me. I've never had to do the calculations, but it doesn't sound like a terribly onerous thing to do. And directionally, it would assist with one of the problems that I think we've encountered. So I think it's a good idea.
And I think we have more than anecdotal evidence that there is also gaming of the current rules in terms of what I described earlier, looking for gas-generating units that are very broad and have a big headroom. Darryl?
Just to add to what Sue's just said, I think, and coming out of Philippe's comment, I think actually the current system is an inducement to create the biggest possible CGUs, because it allows you to protect the goodwill you've purchased from. And so what we've got now is the wrong kind of inducement to go the wrong way. And in some ways, I think the fact that it might force people to look at CGUs in smaller is actually a very big positive. I actually thought that Martin's example is a really good one to think about in this space, and I think it's because it actually illustrates both sides of the equation. Mm. So taking Martin's example, where I combine two units, old goodwill, pre-ac goodwill and purchase goodwill, into a single unit, I get to a point a year later and realize that my discount rate has changed, and as a consequence, the overall goodwill has fallen. Under the old model, even though it is clear that change in discount rate affects both types of goodwill, both the acquired goodwill and the pre-act goodwill, what I would do is I would take all of the knock against the pre-act goodwill and show nothing in my income statement. Mm. Under the new proposal, I would do the opposite. I'd take all of it to... Now, I think the question we would almost need to ask ourselves then is, which is the better outcome in terms of giving information to people looking at those financial statements? And one could argue that the way to do it then is to allocate it on a proportional basis between old and new. But then I think we do start getting into complexity. And perhaps the important thing here is, I think what users were asking us for is that they were saying that the signals they were getting about goodwill were coming too late in the process. And what this does is it provides a signal about what's happening to your goodwill much, much earlier in the process. And if we think that's the objective, then I think this does go a long way towards meeting that.
Mary?
I want to encourage the staff to pursue this. The reason I put my support that way is, one, it's a brand new idea. And it isn't so often we get actual brand new ideas as opposed to going back and revisiting other things. And in terms of pursuing this, I see two immediate avenues rather than saying I want to expose this, because I think we have to think about the package. The first thing about this is, I think we, as others have said, have got to be very clear that this is not the all singing, all dancing, fixes everything, can go home now. But I think it's one of the problems that was identified is too little, too late, attributed to the buffer. This is meant to address only that. It doesn't deal with other drivers of too little or too late, and it and other issues about complexity and cost. I think I'd be very clear that it's got some conceptual compromises in it for the sake of simplicity, because we are aware of the concern, the parallel concern about the complexity and cost of these analyses. So if we're going to add anything on top of that, we want to make sure it's very simple, which may have some flaws, and I think you can pick up the point that Darryl made about it's still a signal that something is a problem, and the possible behavioral effects, as Philippe put it, and put them out there about whether it's good or bad. But in terms of how we move it forward, before we kind of jump to the yay, let's expose it and see what people think. I think we have two opportunities in the near future. One is, I think we're still expecting to have a joint discussion with FASB in June. And since they have the same standard and are, you know, and even though they have different and specific impairment requirements, I think they're struggling with some of the same issues. I think to talk bilaterally with them, because we're looking at the same things at the same time, would be good, and see if another group, how another group of people reacts to it, whether they think some of the flaws that, for example, Martin has identified outweigh the benefits it would bring. And the other is with ASAP, and, you know, get reactions there. And before we go ahead and expose it, because I think when we expose it, isn't a trial balloon, what do you think? I think it's, we've done enough to think that this is the answer.
Almost goes without saying. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I think we will definitely American friends.
But I think this is a very good thing to be putting forward, as long as there's truth in labeling. About, you know, what it could accomplish and yeah, the compromises, but the cost considerations.
I don't know what the timetable is for further proposals. I think if you're going to put it forward, I would preferably do it in combination with other proposals that would address the cost issue, for example, so that people get a complete picture rather than a one-sided picture. Okay, Stephen.
Darrell mentioned the proportionate allocation between the two as a way of resolving Martin's problem, and you validly raise concerns about that, but I don't think we should dismiss it because it would resolve that issue. I don't think it is more complex if done in a basic way, because you have the two numbers, and just doing 75%, 25% seems pretty simple to me. Of course, to resolve the issues that you identify, you could make it more sophisticated. So you could ask for a new purchase price allocation on the data, etc. But that clearly then adds complexity. But what we do know is that allocating all of the impairment to the pre-acquisition, the existing goodwill is wrong. All of the impairment, to Marty's point, to the acquired goodwill, well, that probably is wrong as well. A proportionate allocation is better. It's not going to be perfect for the reasons you identified, but then none of this is perfect. So I don't think you should dismiss the proportionate allocation.
Thank you. Yes, if there is no additional significant cost and complexity, then maybe it's a good idea to go ahead. However, it seems to me, you know, conceptually, you know, this might be a new breakthrough to recognize some internally generated good deal, maybe in near future. So, if I guess, you know, this if we can measure headroom, or previously we used a different terminology. So, if we can measure this kind of a thing without any big cost and complexity, then maybe we can introduce internally generated good deal as another intangible. So I'm saying, you know, if we constituents are happy with this kind of a new idea, but they don't think there's no big cost and complexity, then maybe this is maybe quite kind of some, you know, eliminating some kind of some the challenge that we, our current accounting system has, you know. So,
although Chung-Wu, the headroom approach has, as part of the sort of simplifying assumption, is that we don't then allocate that between what would be internally generated goodwill, what would be unrecognized parts of intangibles or revaluations of land and that sort of thing. So it would, to go that extra step that you've just described, I think would be quite a bit more work for companies to do.
Yeah, I understand that you explained that there are multiple components of this headroom. However, when we ask the companies to calculate this amount, they will consider kind of these components, how to behave in the total amount of that headroom. So basically, it's a kind of a one more step. You know, there may be many people would like to have such kind of intangibles on our balance sheet. So this might be a very good step for
going to the bright future of accounting model. So in that sense, you know, if there's no good resistance to preparedness, then maybe it's a very good try to give up more information to the markets.
Martin.
I forgot to ask a question. And this pre-acquisition headroom could also be a pre-acquisition deficit. And do you propose that also this pre-acquisition deficit, if that exists, would be then added to the goodwill test, or do you only propose it if it is in headroom?
We're only proposing a headroom, but we did consider the fact that if there's a deficit, it may be an immediate impairment.
Would you not be required in any case under current accounting to identify an impairment if you had a CGU that was at a deficit to its asset value?
I guess it would be a different timing from
what kind of impairment. What kind of impairment would you recognize to that? Because you would not do that.
Yeah.
Nobody would, if you haven't allocated any goodwill to that, you would not do any test. So if it is negative, what would you do?
Well, I think it perhaps raises the question, why haven't you identified a trigger? Because you know, what has caused that deficit? And
you don't not require to do that. If it is not currently not any goodwill allocated to this cash generating unit, you are not obliged to do any test.
You are if there's a trigger. Mm-hmm. And so I suppose the question I would have is, well, why didn't you identify a trigger if in fact you've got a deficit?
But that is not my question. Man, if you have a deficit, let's assume that. What kind of impairment would you book prior to that? Nothing.
You might book an impairment of fixed assets, other identified intangibles, etc., that are
within. What standard we're doing that?
Yeah, it's IS36.
Yeah. IS36 requires you, if you had not allocated, to do an cash generating unit impairment test. Is new to me. Why is that?
We need to be at a lower level.
It might be at a lower level, but the CGU is
no,
the sum of its
parts. Question was for that
no.
CGU.
Yeah. But if you have a deficit at the CGU, then presumably it has to relate to one of the pieces of the CGU.
Yeah, maybe. But maybe it relates to the internally goodwill offset, it's negative. Why do you require then to book an impairment of the existing assets in that?
Well,
based on what standard? I don't see that. But this is not my question. Let's assume this exists.
I think it would then be.
And you don't allocate them. Let's assume it is an CGU with fair value assets, and you don't have to book anything. But is a negative thing. Do you think in banks currently they have a lot of fair value assets, but still I think the fair value of that investment banking business is negative or is not covering really the assets, because otherwise the book value of these assets are not higher than the fair value of the whole company. We have this kind of situations in banks currently. Let's assume this kind of situation. But I think if that should be then. Method is okay if it is a negative kind of buffer, and if this method should be some conceptual basis, I think we should include that also, because otherwise this is only to address this kind of user think okay it is too late,
but Martin,
and not conceptual basis. That is my earlier
just
point.
Just to think about your example though, and look at it. If you were now reassessing that CGU, let's say your year end was a day later, you would identify at that point an impairment of your purchase goodwill, which is actually incorrect. It was a purchase of your, so under our current accounting, when you came to reassess that CGU at your next reporting period, if you put together a unit that had positive purchase goodwill with negative pre-AC goodwill, and you measured the goodwill of the combined unit, you are going to end up with a deficit.
Yeah, but it is then
this
higher.
Is
but the problem is it is higher.
Deficit
this is
to
my
the
problem.
Right period, which
yeah, but
is
it lower.
Belongs to pre-AC.
But if you don't include this pre-acquisition negative goodwill, the impairment amount is different.
Could I just?
That is my point. You maybe have an impairment. I agree to that. But what is the amount? And if you're then adding a negative amount, which were pre-acquisition, the amount is different.
Well, I think what you would have to do is that your indicator in this circumstance was you were combining it with something, you measured it, and you came up with a negative. And I think even though IS36 requires, even though IS36 suggests that you need indicators in order to have, or that you follow indicators in order to test a CGU for impairment, I think if you tested a CGU and discovered it was impaired, that indicator approach doesn't stop you from recognizing that impairment. So what you have is a circumstance here where you have tested a CGU in compliance with IS36, and recognized in that CGU that you actually have a negative
situation, you have an impairment. You would then be required to impair it first and then combine the impairment.
But then my question is how? Because if you have a bank which has only fair value as at NZ, it's only fair valued. And currently there's a typical situation in the banks because the fair value of the banks is really lower than the book value of the banks. That is, we observe in each and any banks in Europe currently. This situation, and if you identify that for a cash, let's assume your investment bank is in one cash generating unit, all fair value assets, and then you identify the situation, you are not required to book any impairment. Based on what standard? I don't see that.
Yeah, Martin, what I think you're describing a situation where the allocation of an impairment under IAS 36 is limited to the higher of the fair value of the individual asset and its and zero, and so therefore you wouldn't go below the fair value of the individual asset, and that's an element perhaps in part of the mixed measurement model that we have. There's probably other factors as well that that contribute.
Mary has a solution.
I don't have a solution, but I think I have a suspension of this at this point in time, which is, I think Martin's point is a good challenge when you think about service industries with lots of unrecognized intangibles, etc. So that when you bring this paper back for consultation, I think bringing up that, you know, having the time to think through a simple example and bring it up and seeing if that's a flaw that outweighs some of the benefits as we evaluate it further. I don't think we'll make progress here at the table.
Yeah. So, two last comments.
Yeah, quickly. The my tepid support for this thing has not warmed up at all. I didn't hear anything that made anything simpler in all of this. It was just, just one complexity on top of another. But I'm going to go to a process question if we're going to do this. I actually do buy into, but this is a brand new idea and we don't get all that many of them. So it, but if you, the date of acquisition, you compute the pre-acquisition headroom. Right? If you didn't have disposals or restructurings, if the discount rates stay the same, that number would be a constant number for, if not forever, for a very long time. Is that right?
Whilst you've got goodwill in the unit.
What's that?
Whilst there's goodwill in the
unit. But that number, we'd always sort of, whatever that pre-acquisition headroom is, you would sort of subtract it from the computed fair value so you don't get credit for it, right?
Well, it would continue to exist in the impairment test as long as you have goodwill existing in the unit, and then it would be.
But doesn't over time, though, the, I'll call it the business and operational drivers sort of will likely, whether or not we give credit for it, they probably will consume whatever pre-acquisition situation, you know, is absorbed or used or something. It should drop over time, should it not?
It also gets replenished.
What's that?
It also gets replenished.
But it's not pre-acquisition if it's replenished. That's something that emerged later.
Mm. If anything, it would be coming closer to Martin's request for a remeasurement.
No, but keeping the remeasurement aside, if we didn't do a remeasurement, I don't think you were proposing we should do that, just the complexity. That number would stay a constant for a very long time, right?
Yeah.
But does that make sense? So that's the, you know, that you don't, somehow I think you absorb, consume, utilize whatever part of that business that gave rise to it is. I mean, the reality is it probably does get subsumed in some capacity, would it not?
That is a limitation of the.
It's a big limitation.
No, but Gary, is that an argument for amortization?
That was my punchline. I was waiting for Michelle's answer. And the answer is yes, it is an argument for amortization, which is where I think, that should be part of the solution. I'm okay with an impairment testing, but some apparently amortization makes sense to me. But anyways, you were 30 seconds ahead of my counterpunch.
Doug, just quickly, I think Changgu made a good point. We have to show the ingredients of the headroom. And although it is difficult, but it's necessary. And I think the difficulty of this approach is, in a sense, we cannot measure PAH directly. And that actually, in a sense, if you try to do that, you are obliged to measure the corporate value of your own. And eventually, the PAH will be the residual. So we are trying to offset residual against residual. So that is the difficulty of this approach. And also, it contains other assets as well. And as I explained, I made a mistake when I made a comment. I said FIFO, but I was trying to say LIFO. Yes. Yeah? So LIFO approach, so some different approach. We enforce some different approach for other assets as well. So therefore, to show the ingredients of assets you have would be really important.
Okay, well, Michelle, I think you received some headroom to go ahead with this proposal. And I think there were a lot of valid questions asked that you need to explore.
Thank you.
All right, let's continue with the disclosure initiative. Okay.